Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to this episode of New Books in Latin American Studies. Today we're speaking with Dr. Cindy McCullough about her new book, Sewer of Progress: Corporations, Institutionalized Corruption, and the Struggle for the Santiago River. Cindy McCullough is professor researcher at the Center for Research and Advanced Studies in Social Anthropology, CIESAS, in Guadalajara, Mexico. She has her PhD in social science from CIESAS and her master's in environmental studies from York University. Her research interests include social environmental conflicts, water management, environmental regulation, industrial pollution, and environmental justice. Dr. McCullough, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thanks so much for the invitation and the opportunity to speak about my new book, Red.
I'd like to start off by reading the quote from the Chicago Tribune that you include at the right at the opening of the book in the introduction. On March 10th, 1898, the Chicago Tribune wrote about the Santiago River in this region in western Mexico. Quote, "There exists a masterpiece of nature's handiwork, unrivaled in its own peculiar beauties and environments. It is the great waterfall of Huanacatlan. One's ear gradually becomes conscious of a low, distant murmur, which steadily increases to a deep rumble, and from that to a mighty roar, and presently the tram car comes to a standstill at the very brink of a high precipice, from which is viewed through clouds of vaporous mist the sights of thousands of tons of water, plunging over a wall of gray granite in a steady, unbroken cataract, 360 feet in width, for a sheer distance of 60 feet into a seething, eddying vortex below. For a time, the mind is apt to be held in rapt contemplation of the grand spectacle. Then, by degrees, the senses are awakened to the various characteristics, the effects, and weird vagaries of the foaming, falling waters." Chicago Tribune from 1898. Cindy, what did you find when you first visited the Santiago River and the communities in the river basin? And tell us just a little bit about the origins of this book, Sewer of Progress.
Sure. Yes. Well, this was around the year 2000. I had been in Mexico for a couple of years, and I had been working a little bit with organic campesino farmer from one of the riverside municipalities in the community of Huanacatlan. And of course, when I first saw the Santiago River, which was now about 25 years ago in 1998, I encountered a very different panorama. I encountered communities that sort of turned their back to a river that was a source of foul odors, toxic foam, and disease. And even though at that time I wasn't there related to the river, I first went as part of a short project I was working on with Friends of the Earth Canada that had to do with agricultural issues and pesticides, which is when I met this organic farmer, Ezequiel Macias. And then when I was doing my master's at York University, as you mentioned, I continued working with Ezequiel. And so traveling from Guadalajara, which is where I continue to live now, traveling there to Huanacatlan and crossing this bridge over the Santiago River, right over the waterfall that is described in this quote from the Chicago Tribune. And as I mentioned in the book, and this is true, I would be coming along in the bus, and when I saw that we were getting near the river, I would take a very deep breath and try and hold my breath until we had crossed over the waterfall, crossed over the river, and were getting a little bit further away because the odor was so foul. And this left you know, lingering questions in my mind. Obviously, it was something I talked about with Ezekiel and other people in the community at that time. You know, how had this happened? Why was the river like this? And, you know, about this same time, community groups started to form because of the health effects. You know, I could, you know, just my own very limited experience, hold my breath as I was going over the bridge. But the people living in the communities obviously were living with this river and breathing the toxins that are emitted by the river day in and day out.
Yes, and you talk about, I mean, just to drive home the extremity of the sensory experience of the river nowadays, and well, 20 years plus ago as well. You, from August 2003, you cite this instance when you were at the bridge, I think, which you suggest, quote, "I run from the bridge because that foam burns, it leaves rashes, it infects."
Yes, that my first incursion, let's say, into the trying to understand the topic of the river was in making a documentary video that was focused on the broader basin. The Santiago River is part of the Lerma-Chapala-Santiago basin. And we were looking at what was happening in Lake Chapala as well as in the Santiago River at that time. And in a way, we were fortunate when we reached the waterfall that day, because there was a lot of foam. So in terms of capturing in video how dramatic the situation is, it was a very lucky moment. But when the foam that was being whipped up in a small whirlwind, when it started to come over the bridge and could have fallen on us, then I ran off. And of course, the cameraman at that time, Javier Romo, stayed to capture the images. But, you know, and I'm laughing about this, but I also spoke to people, patients now who have gone through kidney transplants, who were students in a school overlooking the waterfall, and where that foam would reach the balcony of the school. And as children, they were playing with this foam. Obviously, it's not just the foam that would have affected their health, but the issue of kidney disease, of cancer, of other very serious disease of very high prevalence in these communities is one of the main sort of concerns that sparked local organizations to denounce the situation of the Santiago River. And those organizations and that work is what sparked me, you know, to continue working on this issue and to want to do this research, which isn't focused, let's say, on the environmental health tragedy per se, but on what I argue and firmly believe is one of the main causes of this dramatic situation, which is the industrial pollution of the Santiago River and the institutional logics that leave the industrial sector basically unregulated in this region.
Yes, could you elaborate on that a little more, and in terms of the institutional logics that have facilitated this incredibly destructive and tragic situation there, the neoliberal logics, as you put it, in the book, and then just say anything else you like in terms of the book's kind of main arguments and contributions to a broader literature, if you like.
Sure. I am very focused on, in the book, on this particular case, but it can't be understood without looking not only at what's happening in Mexico, but where this type of manufacturing in the global south sort of fits into the global economy. So we have this dramatic river pollution, which is affecting the lives and health of several hundred thousand people in riverside communities. And we have protest ongoing since the early 2000s, calling for river cleanup, denouncing the situation. And so I started this research with a very rather simplistic question. I don't think it's simple to answer, but a question of basically, why is this river continuing to be polluted by industrial effluents, despite, you know, several decades now of community protests and demands for cleanup? And we've seen government response, of course, it's not a complete inaction, but the response has evaded systematically any control of industrial sources of pollution. So when I tried to answer this question, I thought it was important to understand, how are the institutions that are involved here, both on the government side and in the private sector, what are their logics? What are the logics of environmental regulation? And then from industry, to the extent possible, how do they understand their role in this situation, discursively in public, when they've had to give voice to respond to the situation, and also in the day-to-day practices of complying with environmental laws and regulations, and how do they give voice to what they believe is their environmental performance. So this took me to two main arguments, basically, or arguments structured around two main concepts, one being institutionalized corruption. And here, I always think it's important to state, because when we hear the word corruption, automatically we go to the illicit enrichment of public servants, which is certainly any definition of corruption normally centered around that concept. But with institutionalized corruption, I'm not referring to acts that lead to the illicit enrichment of public servants, but to a whole systemic logic of how environmental regulations work in the country, not to the benefit of individual public servants, but to the benefit of the private sector more broadly. So we have a system of very lax environmental regulations that are very scantily enforced, very poorly enforced. The system is constructed, the logics of the system are constructed such that there's a very high dependence on self-monitoring, self-regulation. A lot of, in terms of water pollution, a lot of the information that is generated is self-reported information, which is again scantily enforced or overseen. And we also have, which I found one of the most concerning aspects, you have the private sector very much embedded in the processes by which the environmental regulations themselves are developed and approved. Also, in terms of the private sector, because I think there is a tendency when we're talking about this type of issue, and even from the social movements, you know, to look towards the state and to demand from the state, but we don't often sort of turn towards the private sector and put them under the same scrutiny, even from academic research. And there are challenges, and maybe we can delve into that speaking about later chapters. There are challenges in terms of how can we subject these private actors to the scrutiny of academic research when there is so little information that is publicly available about their environmental performance or their polluting activities. And in terms of the private sector, I found it important to understand the logics of how you have this ongoing pollution of the Santiago River, to speak of a myth of the multinational. In this particular river basin, what I identified up until the point of this waterfall, which is where we have the most dramatic health effects for the community, about 700 manufacturing facilities covering a very wide range of different types of industry, among them about 71 non-Mexican corporations, foreign-owned corporations, which were mainly in the electronics industry, automotive industry, chemical industry, and food and beverages. We also have the tequila, important tequila distilleries here in the basin. So why is it important to talk about a myth of the multinational? I think for sort of two reasons. On the one hand, the idea that the large corporations are environmentally benign, that that large transnational corporations go above and beyond Mexican regulations because they have their own strict internal codes of conduct with which they must comply. This becomes a discourse at the local level that justifies not inspecting or not overseeing the actions of these types of corporations. And more broadly, it justifies a system based on self-monitoring and even generating environmental regulations via consensus. So I think that, you know, these ideas of trying to understand the logics of environmental regulation in terms of institutionalized corruption and understanding how the idea of the transnational corporation as a green, environmentally responsible actor is not only relevant, you know, for this case, but can help understand other types of environmental conflicts involving industry, involving this type of pollution or other environmental impacts of transnational corporations in the global south. That is my hope, anyhow.
And you talk about in the introductory section too, in introducing some concepts that have been helpful and built upon here, the notion of Smith's notion of ruling relations, and I think you do a really good job throughout this book of kind of engaging with all the different institutional and individual and community actors from top to bottom of the kind of social spectrum. So could you talk a little about how this ruling relations approach works? I mean, you were kind of getting into it a little bit anyway, but, and then how this it's at one point, you note how it's so problematic sometimes to focus on the version of the state that you mentioned that doesn't really square with the kind of neoliberal capitalist states that Mexico represents and other governments as well and arrangements.
Yes, when I was wanting to do this research, and I knew it was obviously going to be important to look at these institutional logics and how environmental regulations actually work, but also the power relations between government actors and the private sector, which is not necessarily easy to view, certainly not directly accessible as an individual researcher. I was very happy when I started to read about institutional ethnography, which is Dorothy Smith's methodological strategy or approach, wherein she describes how we can study these ruling relations that involve, obviously, both economic actors, political actors, et cetera, et cetera. And what this approach to me contributed was a way to think about how we can scrutinize these logics and these actors. Also, and importantly, by understanding that a lot of these relations are mediated via documents, policies, inspection reports, and particularly looking at my case, you know, how could I understand the actual way that environmental regulations are put into action? One way would be to obtain and gain access to all of these types of documents, meeting minutes in committees where we have the private sector industry actors represented with the government, et cetera, et cetera. And so this approach based in institutional ethnography and understanding the important role of documents allowed a vision into understanding really the power of the private sector in government. And that is one of the main sort of points or arguments in the book. And as you mentioned, we have to recognize that with the shift in the early to mid 1980s in Mexico towards a neoliberal strategy, you had a very sort of faithful, commentators have said, adoption of neoliberal policies in the country, which makes it a very interesting case to look at. And we see these strategies that Noel Castry has described as neoliberal fixes, where you have the private sector very much empowered to take quite a protagonistic role in environmental regulations, particularly. So in that sense, this is a very interesting case of free market environmentalism taken to quite an extreme degree, where at the same time, you know, from an outward perspective, and this is why it was important to look at the actual laws and levels of enforcement, get into a lot of detail. From an outside perspective, a lot of commentators say, oh, Mexico has very good environmental laws and regulations. So for the transnational corporations, there's no accusation of environmental dumping because Mexico has this apparently robust legal framework. So that was why it is important to really go into the details and see that a lot of it is actually environmental simulation of regulation.
Go into quite a bit of the myths and realities at play here in terms of, as you mentioned, environmental regulations that are on the books in Mexico, but then on the ground, kind of what people living in the midst of those contexts know is going on, you know. And just as a historian, I must also say that, you know, we tend to be kind of obtuse about our methodologies in what we publish, but I really appreciate this book, in addition to the introduction, you laying out some key aspects of the research process and methodology. There's an appendix too that includes a great section on research techniques, you know, and including the analysis of documents like financial and sustainability reports, advertising materials of the different companies, pretty much just everything you could possibly get your hands on. I know. So I appreciated that kind of transparency in terms of your own research. And then I know you've just been witnessing and been involved in some of the activism and the struggle to kind of right the wrongs in that situation too over the years. So I appreciated that research component of the book. Maybe we could say a little bit more moving into a couple different sections of the book. Chapter one, you deal with really effectively with the history and background, and you mentioned that when you first got to river basin communities and kind of wondered what was going on, people wanted to start by telling you what the Rio Santiago was. So could you say a little bit about what it was?
Certainly. And the quote that you opened up with alluded to that, because the river, and particularly at this site, at the waterfall, you know, was a tourist attraction. It was called Mexico's Niagara, and visitors would come to appreciate this waterfall. In this area, things started to change in the late 1890s when you had a hydroelectric dam constructed at the waterfall, and then the installation of a textile factory, forming a factory town. That is how the municipality of El Salto, which is one of the two communities on either side of the waterfall, that's how it was founded, as a factory town for this textile factory. And from there, certainly you don't have the quick growth of an industrial corridor, but it starts slowly in the 1930s, near where the river is born in Lake Chapala. You had Nestle set up its first factory in the region. Now there are several in that municipality. Then it's not until the 1940s you have an American chemical factory, and near the Nestle factory on the other side of the river Salinas, which I delve into these two factories and companies in greater detail later in the book. And slowly you have a few other chemical companies coming in downriver. And then it's really not until the 1970s, 80s, and then of course with the North American Free Trade Agreement in the 90s that you start to see the growth of industry, particularly here to the south of the Guadalajara metropolitan area, in El Salto and in the whole sub-basin, which is the most polluted area of the river, the El Ahogado Basin. And we should mention that the Upper Santiago River here in this highly polluted area, the whole industrial corridor is spurred by the presence of Mexico's second or third largest urban conglomeration here, the Guadalajara metropolitan area. I say second or third because sometimes Monterrey is ahead of us, and sometimes we're the second largest city in the country. But
and in addition to that, Cindy, Lake Chapala, can you orient listeners about the importance of that body of water in Mexico and the region?
Yes, Lake Chapala is Mexico's largest natural lake. There are some dam reservoirs that are larger, but Chapala is the largest lake in Mexico, and it's gone through very severe ups and downs. It also, of course, is quite highly polluted because the whole basin of the main river that supplies Chapala, the Lerma River. The Lerma River, its origins are near Mexico City in the state of Mexico. And it traverses another very important industrial and agro-industrial region from the state of Mexico, the state of Querétaro, Guanajuato, Michoacán, very intensive industrial and agro-industrial activities in this whole region. And it's also been affected in terms of water quantity, water flows. There was a very serious crisis in the 1950s when the water level reached about 14% of the lake's capacities. And then another very serious crisis in the early 2000s when it almost reached levels as low as 1955. And this affects the flows into the Santiago River as well. They're all controlled via hydraulic infrastructure. There's no sort of natural outflows following the rainfall between Chapala and the Santiago River, which is another major challenge in terms of thinking of the restoration of the Santiago River Basin. And Lake Chapala continues to also be the main source of drinking water for the Guadalajara metropolitan area. So it's a very complex river basin, wider river basin, including the Lerma and Chapala sections of the basin.
And then the Ocotlan El Salto Industrial Corridor officially was established and populated with an increasing number of companies beginning in about the late 60s. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. That's when it sort of starts to intensify, and the effects in the river started to be very clear in the early 1970s. Different witnesses and authors cite 1973, 1974 as the years when there were major fish kills in the river. There had been, you know, important local fisheries, and the local population definitely enjoyed the river as a source of not only, you know, fish, but recreation, swimming, and there's tourism, et cetera, et cetera. And the major fish kills happened in the 1973, 1974. And we can basically say since that time, water quality has never been recovered. Those particular incidences are directly related by the local population to particular factories that set up. Certainly there's no direct evidence from that time. But in terms of what the population perceived, it was two chemical factories, one American chemical factory, Huntsman, and a Japanese chemical factory, Kimikao, that they relate to these major fish kills that changed, basically changed this landscape and this territory, you know, since that time.
And you mentioned that community members up and down the river basin, I mean, have not just sat idly by. In chapter 2 of your book, Chronicle of a Struggle, The Negation and the Terror, could you talk a little about that chronicle of a struggle and kind of especially how community organizing efforts have unfolded in the last couple of decades, maybe in particular?
Yeah, the chapter tries to highlight some of the main actions of the local community organizations and what has been the response from state actors and from industry. So you have the first community organization, Instituto Vida, that starts off, you know, in what may seem like a sort of naive or innocent way of approaching the issue with letters to the president, you know, saying that this problem is happening in the river. And this started out because they, as parents at the local elementary school, they started to see that a lot of children were missing school because they were sick. And the parents started talking about this and relating it to what was happening at the river and started with these denouncements in letters, in complaints to the Federal Bureau of Environmental Protection, PROFEPA, and really terrible responses from the authorities at that time, where, you know, I tried to argue that at the beginning, it seemed possible from government actors just to deny that there was any problem. Certainly that strategy has not been possible to maintain as more evidence has been made available of the level of pollution. And I talk about one particular incident that happened in 2008 that also galvanized protest and made this issue more broadly known in the country, which was a tragic event where a very young child, an 8-year-old boy, fell into the confluence of the El Elgado Canal and the Santiago River when he was playing with friends who was living in a poor social interest housing development in La Azucena. And he took a few mouthfuls of water. And because of that, he became gravely ill. Later that day, his mother took him to hospital. He fell into a coma and died 2 weeks later. This incident, you know, brought the level of pollution starkly to the fore. A lot of these impacts, of course, are chronic, you know, on the health of the population. But this was, you know, a very dramatic event. And it also forced industry to respond to what had happened, because there was evidence of arsenic, the high levels of arsenic in the blood and the urine of this young boy. So industry was also called to account. And there was a protest shutting down the center of Guadalajara for several hours anyhow of the residents of El Salto and Juanacatlan and other riverside communities. So in this chapter, I go into the very diverse types of actions that local community organizations have taken, not only Instituto Vida, but very importantly, another organization that is still very active to date, Leap of Life or Un Salto de Vida. And, you know, this is include denouncing the situation with ethical tribunals, with the Commission for Environmental Cooperation, which was created in the wake of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And it has included just a wide variety of protests, documenting the case, visits of special rapporteurs of the United Nations, etc. It's quite a long and involved story, but it shows both the diversity and creativity of the actions of the local organizations and really the obstinance of industry and state actors in taking responsibility and even accepting the evidence that exists of the effects of that on the health of the population of this severe environmental pollution.
Thanks for that. And then we'll come back in just a moment to kind of what you think the outlook might be and what those you know, community members and movements and organizations are currently doing and challenges faced. But in the ensuing chapters, chapter 3, for instance, unregulated environments in the Santiago River, you mentioned a couple of the companies involved in the pollution of the river over time. But could you talk a little more about multinationals in the region and what you mentioned about this perception that they somehow are going to be, you know, greener or develop in more sustainable ways?
Certainly, yeah, that's really the focus of Chapter 5 on corporate sustainability myths and realities, where, I mean, in the region, we have some, you know, well-known household brands that have factories that are mentioned, you know, IBM, Hershey's, Honda, Nestle, and you also have a lot of transnational corporations that are supplying the branded companies so that they wouldn't be household names, but they're developing
subsidiaries
precursors or auto parts or et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think, you know, not many people have heard of ZF, which is a German auto parts manufacturer, but maybe the suspension that one has in one's own vehicle perhaps came from them. So we don't, you know a lot of these companies by name, but certainly they're important parts of the supply chain of, you know, consumer goods. So in this chapter, what I tried to look at is what is the discourse around these types of corporations, and what can we say empirically? You know, what evidence is there? And what spheres of information exist? Because, as I mentioned, it's very hard to gain access to reliable and sufficient information on industry practices. So, you know, I looked at one sphere of information being what the industry says itself, and looking at their sustainability reports, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one could say, you know, those are just advertising materials and there's not much of interest in there. But I think, you know, understanding, you know, is it greenwashing? What is greenwashing? And to what extent does this demonstrate or manifest some aspect of what greenwashing is interesting in and of itself, but also from a more local perspective, you know, do these reports contribute to a community's right to know about their exposure to toxins locally? You know, if community actors are apparently one of the important stakeholders of these types of reports for companies, what can we glean from them on their environmental performance at the local level? So that was one sphere of information that I looked at. Then I delved a bit deeper on four companies, Nestle, Huntsman, American chemical company, Celanese, another American chemical company, and Kimikao, a Japanese chemical company. And I chose these four companies because there was some further information available on the actual quality of water they were discharging into the Santiago River, because their effluents had been tested in one or more government contracted studies on the Santiago River. So there's not a lot of information on the quality of industrial effluents going to the river, but there were several large government contracted studies that was sort of related to plans to use water downstream in another water supply dam, the Arcediano Dam. That was sort of the origin of these studies having been undertaken. But thankfully, that dam has not been built, and the studies gave us some information on what is happening in the Santiago River. So I was able to contrast some of the discourse here with some evidence on the actual, you know, polluting effects of these companies. And then, you know, contrast that also with interviews in several of the cases with personnel, environmental health and safety personnel from these factories. In documents were important, as I mentioned, but the interviews with both state actors, you know, and environmental and water authorities at the federal, state and municipal level, also with representatives of the environmental health and safety areas of a number of companies were very important. And what we see here is, you know, the divergence between this idea of the large transnational corporation that has to comply with its internal environmental regulations and the evidence of ongoing non-compliance in the case of these companies where we have evidence. And even beyond that, you know, one of the cases that I found quite funny was Celanese. They were producing cellulose acetate in their factory on the shores of the Santiago River until the factory closed in 2019. It had been there since 1947. But it was funny because even in documents obtained from the National Water Commission, they had asked the National Water Commission for leniency in their discharge permit to be legally able to discharge higher levels of pollutants than what is permitted in the very lax Mexican discharge standard. So not only, you know, we have evidence of noncompliance, but they're asking for leniency to be able to pollute above and beyond what is allowed in Mexican legislation. In another case for Nestle, for example, they stayed in many of their sustainability or shared value reports. Shared value is the terminology that they use, that they have their own Nestle environmental regulations. Certainly, they don't set out exactly what those regulations are. And when asking directly, they responded that actually the idea is just to comply with the regulations in each country where they operate. But in Mexico here, we have clear evidence that they have not complied with Mexican regulations for wastewater discharge on an ongoing basis. So anyhow, it was very important in this chapter to try and sift between the myths and realities and see how the discourse that states that the transnational corporations are environmentally responsible is a main justification for such a weakly enforced and poorly designed system of environmental regulation.
And you know, Cindy, ever since I've began to find out about more and more about the Santiago River case and its pollution, I've wondered myself, what are the standards? What exactly are they, you know, for what's being discharged by industries into that river? And chapter four goes into the National Wastewater Discharge Standard in detail. And I wonder if you could mention just a little about that and what the latest development with that standard has been.
Sure. And for me, this was actually one of the most interesting parts of the research because, you know, starting out and certainly having worked with the local community organizations on this issue first from an NGO myself. It was very clear to me, as it was to certainly many other actors, that the National Discharge Standard needed to be updated, needed to be modified. But it wasn't clear if that was taking place, who were the actors involved, what were the processes, and sort of unfolding that story led to a very clear case to analyze the power relations between government and industry actors. So what we have in Mexico is sort of an interesting history where in the late 1980s, early 1990s, you have the approval of 44 discharge standards that were based on different industry sectors. So you had a standard for, let's say, dairy production and one for petrochemical production, et cetera, et cetera. And those only were in effect, you know, some for a few years, some for even less, because then in 1996, we have the approval of what has been in what was in effect until March of this year, which was a single standard that replaced all 44. This was called a simplification. So now this one single standard was for all wastewater discharged international waters, and it was sort of called a baseline standard that did not take into account the origin of the discharge. So it didn't matter if you were a dairy factory or a chemical factory or metalworking or what have you, the origin was not taken into account. And it was a very lax standard. One of the actors that I cite, you know, described it very nicely as a myopic standard because there was no single parameter contemplated in the standard that was looking at synthetic organic pollution. And one of the arguments at that time, certainly was clear at the time it was approved that, you know, this was a major oversight. One of the arguments at that time, you know, and this is shortly after the signing of NAFTA, and this was lauded by actors such as, you know, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development as wonderful, you know, to have this simplification of wastewater standards. But at the time they said, okay, you know, the standard doesn't contemplate certain specific contaminants that different sectors are going to be generating, but will put particular discharge conditions in the individual discharge permits. So that will help, you know, to correct for the deficiencies of the standard itself. And I mention this because in the preceding chapter, in chapter three, where I'm looking at in a lot of detail the inspections and permits in the river basin and the actions of the National Water Commission. So when I looked at about 50 permits for industries in the Santiago River Basin, and this is, you know, true in other regions of the country, the particular discharge conditions were not used, basically, to correct for the deficiencies of the general wastewater standard, because in the particular discharge conditions, you have the same lax and scant number of parameters as in the main discharge standard. So we have this standard from 1996, and a process starts in 2007 to have this standard change. And what was important to understand was who decides and how are decisions reached on changing the standard. And, you know, some of the environmental activists that I was working with, and this was my thinking as well, thought, okay, this is a legislative process. But no, this is not a legislative process. This is a faculty of the executive branch of government, in particular in the Ministry of Environment and Natural Resources, SEMARNAT. And you have a committee that oversees the development of new standards and the modification of existing standards, which is called COMARNET. And strangely enough, of the members of this committee, basically half are industry chambers and associations. So in chapter four, I delve into the process through which there was debate around the changes of this National Discharge Standard, which the process, as I mentioned, started in 2007 and, you know, did not reach fruition until 2021 because of a lot of opposition from industry. And I look at the practices within this committee, how industry has veto power, and how basically, in many cases and over many years, the general practices were to develop regulations via negotiation or via consensus with the industry associations and industry actors. Certainly, consultations with affected parties on a standard is one thing, but I think giving them veto power, giving industry actors veto power over modifications of environmental standards is certainly a level of empowerment that is not conducive to protecting environments and local community health. So that is basically the main topic of Chapter 4. And at the end, we see that a new environmental standard was, in fact, approved. It came into effect finally in March of this year, March of 2023. And it does include some improvements, a few parameters that will hopefully better control at some point in the future toxic contaminations. It includes acute toxicity, chemical oxygen demand, some parameters that give us a better idea of what industry is discharging. But we face, again, the main challenge of enforcement, which is one of the topics that I deal with in Chapter 3. And on that front, unfortunately, the panorama is not positive, because we've seen even in more recent years with the current federal administration, the number of inspections of the National Water Commission dropped by 72%. So it's a complex panorama, even though we do have a new discharge standard coming into effect this year.
And what do you see as the way forward? I mean, you just kind of alluded to it, but in the book, you mentioned really the need to reconceptualize maybe the approach in terms of the analysis by movements and scholars in terms of really reevaluating the situation in terms of human life and life in ecosystems, life of the river too.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the very obvious conclusions of this research is that, you know, a situation like the Santiago River is only possible by devaluing certain human lives. And, you know, these double standards that industry takes advantage of at the global level, seeking out, well, you know, obviously low wages and, you know, flexible labor conditions are certainly a main attractor for industry, but in lax environmental regulations are also a main attractor. And, you know, that means that certain human lives continue to be devalued for this situation to continue. It is a challenge to think of how things will change. There has been a major state-level strategy focused on, quote, reviving the Santiago River. And while it has been deficient and not successful, I would say it is a testament to, you know, the strength of local organizations to have placed in the center of public debate the challenge of restoring the Santiago River. And I think that those local actors who have many allies, you know, beyond the region and also in academic researchers, et cetera, you know, placing the restoration and revival of this river as a place of life, I think is key to changing the dynamics of power relations, because, you know, certainly state government level, federal government level strategies are within the ongoing pragmatic logics of the status quo. So there, you know, certainly it is the ongoing conflict and challenge of local actors, I think, the only way that the situation of the Santiago River will change is through ongoing protest and denouncement, basically, and hopefully a greater ally building, network building, in which I think as academics, we also have a role. I certainly don't see myself, you know, just sitting by the sideline, on the sidelines, let's say. I think that looking at a case such as this, it is my obligation certainly to become involved as well.
It is a remarkable book, Sewer of Progress. Professor McCullough, what are you working on next these days? Where is your research taking you next?
Well, it's not taking me too far out of this region, but looking at water challenges in a few other directions, particularly related to drinking water supply and drinking water quality, both in terms of over-exploitation of groundwater and the challenge that brings in terms of contaminants such as arsenic and fluoride, and also looking at now the option that is being explored in several large Mexican cities, including Guadalajara, including León, of the potable reuse of treated wastewater. And I'm particularly concerned about how peri-urban areas, marginalized peri-urban areas, are receiving both the poorest service quality in terms of intermittent water service, but also the poorest quality of water, and how the gradient of water quality is unequal across the urban area. So I'm looking more at urban water services and the future challenges of access to clean water in Mexico.
Well, Cindy McCullough, we appreciate your time today. The book is Sewer of Progress: Corporations, Institutionalized Corruption, and the Struggle for the Santiago River, just published by the MIT Press, 2023. Thanks for joining us, everybody, on New Books in Latin American Studies.